The review, very briefly, last time we went through more images underlying science. The scintillae, the four elements, the causal God, the yin-yang, divine number, energy. We'll see a little bit more as we go along why that was so important. I gave it some practical explanations that we realize how the scientific process is really based on an imagistic process. In fact, I had a dream just this week. I went into Pauli's study, and I saw he was reading children's stories. See, that I think that creative mind works with very childlike processes. Another thing which she talked about was if we look at these images and projections, we can begin to apply the feeling function and maybe bring some value, discernment into our use of scientific resources. We talked a bit about Kate Gallais's vision, another example of an image underlying a theory. We talked about then all of this stuff being, all of this stuff being examples of the collective unconscious. And then, so today what we're going to do is go and look at what is the collective unconscious. So today will be pretty much standard Jungian stuff. Some of you will know it, bear with us, but it's certainly a good review. And then Jane had sent us a couple of articles. I thought maybe we'd start with that, wrapping up the science chapter before we go. Do you want to lead us through those, Jane? Put you on the spot?
Let's see. The world without it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I found this in a newspaper, of all things, the Financial Times. But they do have each week, and they have a good arts and literature section, and book reviews, and they're always really good. But there's this multiverse concept,
mm-hmm.
and it's been around for a while, but I guess they started taking it more seriously after 1990. And in 2011, the multiverse concept remains unproven and still rejected by some scientists. But it has entered the mainstream of cosmological thinking, so much so that in this book, The Hidden Reality, the author, Brian Greene, is able to enumerate 9 distinct types of multiple universe worthy of serious discussion.
I know the name Brian Greene.
String
theory.
Okay. Well, I just thought it was interesting that he mentions quantum theory,
mm-hmm.
or quantum physics in here.
Morning.
Morning.
But that there's, I just wondered what this concept of projection is so pervasive.
Right.
Is this a projection, or is it?
That's a very good question.
Is it real?
Yeah.
The universe is based upon replication, and we suspect this replication will be infinite. It's kind of mind-boggling in a way.
Right. The background of this, and maybe you guys can help me a little bit here, you know, this quantum physics idea that a thing can be a particle or a wave, and you only see it one way or the other, you don't see it both at the same time, that has just driven scientists nuts. And the other thing about quantum physics is, remember that the energy levels in the electron are discrete. There's not a discrete issue. Well, that has driven scientists nuts. And the way Pauli and company left it was, hey, this is the way things are. there is discrete energy and there are either-or perceptive situations. Get over it. Einstein couldn't accept that. And they had good nature arguments, so did Bohr and Einstein. A lot of physicists are trying to come up with ways of explaining how can we have discontinuity and complementarity and not violate everything we've understood about physics. And one of the explanations is, well, this gradation, when we're going either or, somewhere in another universe, somebody's doing the same thing, and when we're seeing a wave, they're seeing a particle. That's one way of explaining it. I think, does that sound right to our quantum experts here?
My understanding is they keep coming up with mathematical models that work, but they don't see in the universe, and they're trying to figure out whether those mathematical models are true. But my understanding of some of the complexity theory is it's all based on mathematical models, and they come up with a model, and then they start fitting the world into the model and seeing how it's working.
Well, the problem, how do you prove that there's a Gary and there's a Kathy and there's a Jane in some other universe? So I don't know where you're supposed to go with that, but it is a very respectable alternative to quantum. What they call a Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics is discontinuity is the way it is, get over it. Complementarity is the way it is, get over it. That's just one interpretation of quantum mechanics. It's, I think, the prevailing one. But the multiple universe theory is a competing explanation. And yeah, I would say is it's a projection of the unconscious. But who knows? Someday, I might meet another Gary. I have to take that back.
Well, just because it's a projection doesn't mean it actually doesn't exist.
That's also true.
Level. I mean, we project things, but there's something over there to project onto. So maybe, it could be both also. That we have that projection because in our psyche, is the sense that that's how it is. And the truth is maybe that is how it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so anyway, that's the background.
Yeah, and that there's hidden dimensions. I mean, that whole thing in CERN, is it?
Geneva?
Oh, that they're experimenting with hidden dimensions.
That's beyond me. I don't know if anyone can explain that or not. But
it helps when you explain mass, for one thing. That's why they're...
And gravity, too, right?
Yes, with the same particle, but
right.
Higgs boson.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that again? I'm sorry. It does what?
The hidden dimensions will help them explain mass. They're looking for a particle called the Higgs boson. And they theorize that because gravity appears so weak, this has to do with mass, if the Higgs boson gives the same mass. But gravity appears exceptionally weak compared to the other forces. And they theorize that that's because the Higgs boson relies upon a field. And this field is part of other dimensions. And that explains the weakness.
Yeah, we can't explain how gravity works. Like, things with mass are attracted to each other, but there's no particle, there's no electrical field, there's nothing going from one particle to the other, or from the Earth to the Moon to make gravity work. So the question is, where is the substance which makes gravity gravity? Like electricity, you can,
right.
Demonstrate that.
Each of the forces has a particle associated with it.
Right.
Like the electromagnetic.
There's no graviton.
But there's no particle associated with gravity. And that's what they're looking for on the Large Hadron Collider. And part of their mathematical predictions that made them theorize the Higgs was showed those extra dimensions.
Is it true that at very small, like electrons, very small things, or very large things in the universe is where you have gravity. At our level, you have gravity as the dominant force, but in very small, minute particles or very large cosmoses, there are numbers of different things, and gravity is just one and its relative importance is different.
On a large scale?
Or very large scale,
no.
Or on a very small scale?
No. The reason it appeared that gravity didn't apply on a large scale is because they hadn't discovered dark energy and dark matter. And once they theorized dark energy and dark matter, they understood that, yes, gravity was working on a large scale, but dark matter is not affected, does not affect light, does not affect the electromagnetic force, although it does work with gravity, and that was what blew them away. They couldn't understand, well, how could it only function that way, and that's why they can't explain what that substance is and that energy is, but they know it's there.
And dark matter is matter that's so dense light can't escape, is
no.
That? No.
They don't know what it is.
Oh, they don't know what it is. So dark matter and the black hole are two different things.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Exactly. And last week, we were talking about emergence.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a conflict with emergence and union thought.
Okay.
I've been thinking about this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
In emergence, it's Richard Davidson, he's a neuroscientist,
mm-hmm.
He explains that consciousness, in emergence, they see consciousness as an emergent property of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But this means, this is a conflict with union thought because consciousness is not confined
mm-hmm.
to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a conflict there.
Mm-hmm.
So emergent theory doesn't coincide with union theory.
Not all the time, at least.
No, because then you, what do you do with synchronicity?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think their whole error is locating consciousness in the brain.
Well, exactly. You know, so it's emergence. That's why emergence runs into trouble with certain kinds of religious thought. You know, for example, Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Buddhism, consciousness is not something that's
yeah.
located in the brain. Yeah. And there are even scientists now that are theorizing that consciousness is an integral part of reality, separate from us.
Mm-hmm. That sounds more like it.
And these scientists that are thinking, these neuroscientists that are thinking of consciousness that way, are also tying it together with entanglement and synchronicity. And remember, we talked about that years ago.
See how far ahead of the curve we are.
But they're coming to that.
Yeah, it's about time. Great, thank you.
And entanglement is...
Well, speaking of entanglement, that has to do with your next article.
Oh.
I'm sorry, you're on the spot here. What, you want to talk about your next one in 60 nanoseconds?
Oh, yeah. Well,
yes, I do think it's interesting.
Do you? Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know much about this. Do you? It's also about CERN. It's interesting. Yeah.
Well, they apparently found particles that seem to go faster than the speed of light.
Yeah.
That's the big news. And, you know, depending on who you read, sometimes some scientists would say, well, that's an error in the experiment. Others would say, well, no, we have found particles that go faster than the speed of light. Now, the thing that puzzles me is we've known this for a long time, and I don't get why it hasn't registered more. Now, you have to help me here. Entanglement is, if you take... And I don't know how they do this, but if you take two particles created at the same time, say two electrons, and you separate them, I don't know, what do you put in a test tube or what do you do with it? But anyway.
I think they suspend them on laser. Do you know about entanglement?
A little bit, but I don't know how they experiment.
They suspend the photons with lasers.
I don't remember.
And they suspend it in a laser beam or something?
Yeah, I think so.
However it's done, that you create two particles. You take one here, you put one in Tokyo or wherever. You stimulate one, the other responds instantaneously.
Yes. It's faster than the speed of light.
Faster than the speed of light.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they do it with quarks too. Like
uh-huh.
The quarks have a different spin, and if one's up, the other one instantly will go down.
Uh-huh.
They're a pair.
So this idea that something goes faster than the speed of light isn't new.
This is not a particle going faster than the speed of light. There's
no.
It's a spooky action at a distance.
Correct.
Well, something's going faster than the speed of light.
Yeah, but you can't say it's a particle.
Oh, I see.
They don't know what it is. They don't know how it works.
Right, but it's whatever, it's an immediate reaction. There's no lag time, you know, nothing that could be traveling from one to the other. So how does that signal get there? So that's the question of, you know, how does the action of the distance happen? Is it traveling through some other universe? I mean, you know, they don't know.
Right.
How are they connected?
Yeah, that would be the multiple universe theory again. Is it going through another universe?
That's one way of trying to explain it.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So you see, all these questions come up, and they're, this is really the edge of scientific research. So.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. No, go ahead. Consciousness research is talking about that too, because there are some neuroscientists that think that our neurons might be connected through quantum entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
That accounts for synchronistic phenomena and you know, other things that we can't explain.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's the idea that consciousness is a quantum process.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're coming to.
Mm-hmm.
An integral part of the universe. So it gets right. back down to, in a way, it gets to Jung's idea of the unus mundus.
Yeah. I think it's interesting they're getting away from this brain stuff. And they're neuroscientists. I think that's really important.
The thing I thought that was interesting was, I mean, when you were talking last week about Marie-Louise von Franz thinking that our new image of God is the series of natural integers,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to like a circle or, you know, I thought, well, that's what consciousness is. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's a process that continues to expand that's infinite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's interesting that that is maybe now our idea of God as opposed to some kind of static, you know, process that's a
mm-hmm.
circle and everything stays the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when you read that last week, I finally understood what in the world she was talking about. You
yeah.
know, God image being a series of natural
yeah.
integers.
It's a very hard concept to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
It takes me
it makes
forever.
Sense if you think of consciousness.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of process.
That's
I mean, there's
it.
No end to consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's an infinite expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense. So it's a series of natural integers, you know, an infinite series.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where emergence comes in, because my understanding
yeah.
of emergence is as things and synchronicity is as things get together. The one example they used in the series that I listened to was slime molds. I mean, these little slime things get together because there's not enough food. They will actually grow into a stalk and start moving.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
what they cannot do individually,
mm-hmm.
they can do collectively,
mm-hmm.
and then they can split back up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as if, you know, and I guess that's the emergence, and there's different. There's four different types of emergence, and I can't remember
mm-hmm.
all about
that. They weren't tying that together with synchronicity, were they?
They weren't, but I did.
Oh, well, see, that's what they deny. Mm-hmm. Because they say that in emergence, a thing pulls itself up by its own bootstraps. There is no overall principle outside of that, of those components. That's the whole idea
behind emergence. Right, the part I got from emergence is that as things either come together or split apart, there is a difference between the collective and the individual.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Same with ants. If you put 50 ants on this table, they'll run around until they die. But let's say you have a little break. You have two tables. You have an eighth of an inch between them. And you have food over here. You put 50 ants here. They will run around until they die. If you put 100,000 ants here, or 10,000 ants here, they will together have the intelligence to build a bridge to the other
mm-hmm.
side of the food. And that's an example I've understood as complexity theory, that the whole has more intelligence than the part. So I think it's another example of consciousness isn't located within an individual entity, an individual being. They can twist it any way they want, but to me, that's what's involved in synchronicity. There is an intelligence bigger than us. It's at work. Same idea.
In that theory on the ontology one, we replicate what the individual replicates what the.
Oh, ontology, we.
The big
which
yeah, yeah, yeah.
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 Well, light talk for a Saturday morning.
Did we reach any conclusions?
No. Just everything is, if you ever get confused, just stop and say, everything is everything. And you'll be all right.
Well, I don't think that we can reach any conclusions, because I think even the biggest scientific minds are realizing yes. that there aren't any.
But what we're doing is unearthing the genuine questions, I would say.
Yeah.
And it is fascinating.
And one more thing I'd like to, and I bring this up constantly, so I apologize for everyone who's heard it already, but that movie Sliding Doors gives you two different ways of, something happens to her, she chooses one choice or another choice, and they both lead to an end, which now the end seems very interesting, that they kind of tie it up all neatly, but I think there's, if these are endless, of course, blows to my mind, but...
Like the multiple, you mean the infinite universe?
Yeah.
Like every time we make a choice, then both things happen, you know, and so that those choices continue to split off, so they're infinite.
No. This is, she makes one choice, mm-hmm. she opens the door, mm-hmm. or she doesn't open the door. Mm-hmm. And so it takes you on that journey of when she opens the door, what happens, when she doesn't mm-hmm. open the door, what happens, and then what happens at the end, mm-hmm. so...
Are two different things at the end, or is it the same at the end?
I'm not going to tell you.
Oh.
It's called Sliding Doors.
Okay.
I think Mary Kay was trying to relate the idea of multiverses. That's the
right, exactly.
Right. That each time a choice is made, both choices are made. You know, so you live in this universe where you make choice A, but choice B exists in a multiple universe, and then it goes on, and then it has its own consequences.
Or like an even there's the idea of an infinite number.
Correct. And then so each one has an infinite, you know.
And that's...
That's one of the theories that Gary was talking about.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And what's that called when the choice thing?
Which is an infinite number of universes. It's
infinite number.
Yeah, so it's one of the theories is that everything that can happen does. You know, so that we only experience one set of choices going a particular direction, but that in these other universes, all the other choices you've ever made, you know, the other decision that you didn't make in this universe happened in another one, and then it goes on and it has, you know, like there's another you in another universe that made all those other choices, you know, infinitely. So,
well, that would put a whole new spin on what's spin.
Yeah, like you did the right thing in another life. So, hey, what's the problem? Takes the pressure up.
Takes the pressure.
I mean, you're never going to get it right because you always made all the, you know, right choices and wrong choices all the time.
Phew! Talking about movies, by the way, there's I can't remember the name of it, but it's coming out of a woman who, she was in a car accident or something anyway, but she killed another person. Anyway, there's a universe out there that she gets to take this trip to this other universe and then make another choice. It'll come.
Mm.
And so...
That very similar idea.
Yeah. And... then also, were you aware that there's a movie coming out about Jung and Freud?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'll pass.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd bash as Jung. Does it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What else is new?
Anybody answer Freudian? Is that what I
want? Well, the...
About Sabina.
Yeah, about Sabina Spielrein. And I don't think you think the facts are right.
Mm. Exactly.
In the movie. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, the director who made it, somebody said that he's in a real... like sensationalist, you know, just takes things and twists them to make a vivid presentation. So,
not like Hollywood.
But I think that he's European. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but yeah, it's the same. It's amazing how hard this stuff is for most people to get. Well, let's go just to basic Jung today, and. I don't even know if we'll get through the chapter. As I worked on it, it seemed mighty dense. Parts of it we'll go through fast, parts of it we'll go through slow. Basic idea, projection has both a personal and a collective aspect to it. So, somebody beats me up as a kid, and I don't like him. I say that is bad, but what happens is I become the person as well who beats up other people. But I deny that. And I see that sadist everywhere. So that experience has been interiorized. I become the very person I dislike, but I deny it and I project it. Classic example, some of you may have heard me say this. I have a godson who, when he was young, used to torment his sisters by pulling their hair. And I saw him one holiday and I said, "Boy, you're a little devil, aren't you?" He said, "Yeah." I saw him a year later, still pulling their hair, and I said, "You're a little devil, aren't you?" And he said, "No, I'm a good boy." But the neighbor, he pulls his sister's hair. See, that's how a shadow projection is set up. That's personal. The reason she went through religion and science is to show us that this bit of projection occurs also at the social level. A whole culture thought Zeus controlled the lightning. We now know Zeus doesn't control the lightning. But there were millions of Greeks who would have said, yes, the lightning is Zeus. So collections, projections can also be collective phenomena. That's why she went through religion. That's why she went through science. And what is projected then is what Jung called the collective unconscious. This is one of the reasons he came up with that concept, to explain how whole groups of people can project. And then what are we supposed to do about that? So that's how we've gone from personal projections to collective projections, and now to what is projected, namely the collective unconscious. And so we pick up now with a chapter on the collective unconscious. Just Jung, I'm not going to say 101 because she gets into some complicated stuff, but just very basic Jung. Let's look, and as I say, some parts fast, some parts slow. The last three lines on 77. The empirical findings of contemporary natural science, and through which the dualism of matter and mind psyche may perhaps at the same time be overcome. The point there is, and I think it's easier to grasp with religion. Let's take Zeus or Aphrodite. So if you fell in love, you'd say, well, Aphrodite has caused this. And Aphrodite is a figure out there. Or Zeus has created the lightning. Zeus is a figure out there. As soon as the scientific mind comes along, it says, there's no Zeus out there causing lightning. There's no Aphrodite out there causing you to fall in love with somebody. They don't exist. This is the problem. By criticizing the fact that we are projecting, certainly what you were alluding to, Mary Kay, if it's a projection, then what has been projected is an error. And Jung's hypothesis of the collective unconscious is to say, no, it doesn't exist. It's not that it doesn't exist, it exists in a different way. That's what the collective unconscious is. It's taking all of the errors of judgment about both God and matter, religion and science, seeing what we no longer hold as true, not then dismissing it, but saying it exists on a different plane, in a different level. For example, with matter, the alchemists thought a little man lived in each particle of matter, and what they had to do was free that up. Well, science comes along and says, oh, there's no little man in matter. Matter is inert. Yet we've got the problem of synchronicity. There is some aspect of matter which does seem to contain consciousness, but it's not a little man in there running around doing whatever he's doing inside the piece of matter. So all of these examples, whether science or religion, which the rational mind has rejected, Jung is trying to find a way to recover, not in its original framework, but in a new framework. That's the point of the collective unconscious. And that's what she's saying. Maybe we can get rid of this thing that the gods are only imaginary, or little men in matter are only imaginary, which creates a split between our mind and the physical world by this concept of the collective unconscious, which says there is some truth to that. It's just we have to redefine our levels. That's the point of those three lines. Does that make sense? Y'all look dazed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You are dazed.
No.
No, it makes sense. Okay. Okay, so in that was the introduction to the collective unconscious. What she does, I think we can kind of skim over on 78, is say, you know, this idea, and Jung always does this, whenever he has an idea, he says, am I the first person who thought of this? And he realized, no, I'm not. You can find analogous explanations of this mental world in, and I don't think we need to worry about these, Gnosticism, Stoicism, and so on. Then, at the middle of the page, she discusses Jung's concept of how consciousness is formed, and it is formed through the withdrawal of projections. In other words, Freud would say, you were first conscious of something, and then you projected it. Now, that may be true for personal projections, but it's not true for collective projections. In 500 BC, it wasn't that the Greeks knew Zeus didn't create lightning and then forgot it and projected it onto Zeus. They never knew what was behind and lightning. And so this idea of seeing the psyche outside isn't caused by repression. It is the basic condition of the human being. So about the middle of the page, she says, as Jung emphasized, nothing was thrown out of the psyche originally. Rather, the human psyche as we know it today developed via a long series of acts of interjection. You see there, just a slight aside, you see how important this is for the way we do therapy.
You mean this concept of series of interjections?
Yeah.
That would help people become integrated.
And how would a Jungian do that? How would a Freudian do that? What would be the difference?
Jungian would take it forward to
exactly.
New development.
Yeah.
Freudian would regress it back to, well,
exactly.
What's your parents' problem?
Right,
or something
exactly. So if you see projection as the expulsion of something once known, you'd go back and say, well, this sexual fascination you've got or this resentment you've got, that's a replay of some past experience. Where, and that can be, you know, as you know, Jung never throws out Freud, but he wants to expand and say, maybe it's something that you never were conscious of, and is now trying to come to consciousness. There's no point in finding out where it came from, because it didn't come from anywhere. And so we then look to, we don't say what caused it, we say, where is it trying to take you? She talks a bit about Adolf Bastian, bottom of 78. Jung refers to him, so I'll just mention him. He was a German ethnologist, and I think he, if not the first, one of the first, that articulated clearly the theory that Jung picked up, that myths are externalizations of internal structures. So, see, the old idea would be, well, people saw lightning, and therefore reached the conclusion of Zeus, that experience was interjected, and that explains the projection. Well, I mean, I actually heard one of my theology professors said, oh, this mandala stuff is stupid. It's really that the child has seen the nipple and imprinted the circle. See, that all these things come from imprints to the outer world. Bastian was one of the first guys that said, no, it's the other way around. These structures exist in us first, and sensitize us to the experiences in the world. And then Jung picked that up. And that's what she's dealing with on page 79. Myths and myth religious systems are the first and foremost expressions of the objective psychic process. And then primitive man impresses us so strongly with his subjectivity that we should really have guessed long ago that myths refer to something psychic. A little farther down, psychic contents. The psyche contains all the images that have ever given rise to myths. So what's being projected, remember, while we're doing this chapter, is the psychic structures. I think that's pretty much that page.
Can I go back just a minute? I mean, feeling function keeps coming up because you were talking about morals and feelings and all that business to kind of get together, which I'm not sure I quite understand, but the whole issue of Zeus being out there and controlling the thunderbolts was a reaction to their fear about thunderbolts, and so they projected a person out there or a god out there who could take care of. If they sacrificed to the god, then the god wouldn't kill them, you know, with a bolt of lightning or something like that.
Well, I think more what Jung would say is that what was projected was their own lightning.
Right. Okay. All right. So that's why I'm getting at this feeling thing. So fear would, you don't think would have any...
Well, it would be, then what would they would be projecting is fear of their own lightning.
Okay.
Fear of their own, so we would say really power. Mm-hmm. Zeus would be the projection of our power.
Okay.
Because we try to explain things, right? If we think if we explain something or name it, or then somehow we...
Control.
And that we don't have to worry about it anymore.
But that's, remember, that's secondary. That for Jung, the primary thing is that thing exists in us, period. And then we see it out there. Yes, I think you could say that in this projection, you do mitigate the terror. But that would be secondary. The fact that you have a Zeus to project isn't because of the lightning, it's because of you've got an inner Zeus to begin with. Or let's say an inner powerful component which you then give the name Zeus to and see it out there.
But the fact that it gets put on the lightning would be, I think, is related to your experience of lightning and thunder and even fear and its power and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So it's not for nothing that it's put on that.
It's always this coincidence of two, mm-hmm. but that the structure is primary.
Yeah. But yeah, there's an analogous inner experience, like, oh, I know what that lightning in me feels like. I see it out there. Like, this is a terrifying inner powerful process.
Yeah,
like, but that's it, out there, and, you know, park it out there. And
but
it, right?
At that...
There's a resonance with your internal experience and then the external experience of lightning.
Yeah. At that Greek stage, that isn't conscious.
Yeah. Correct.
But in the Middle Ages, when Christianity debunked paganism, mm-hmm. then one could say, that's how consciousness evolves. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, in regards to Sabina's question to the feeling function, she thinks it comes into play after we've withdrawn.
Absolutely.
I mean,
you can't, if you idolize Zeus, you never assess what he does. Mm-hmm. But when you realize I have a Zeus in me, then you can begin discerning what you want to do with it. Yeah. I think that's one reason why withdrawing projections is so important. You can then begin to discern. Otherwise you don't realize it's you. It's like my little godson didn't realize suddenly that he was the one pulling that girl's hair. Uh Anything else on that? Maybe I was going to skip over it, but because we mentioned it, just this issue of, does an experience cause the image, or does the image predispose the experience? And like my theology professor saying, the nipple causes the fact that the model is so important to us, doesn't explain how the psyche then takes that circle and changes it into many different permutations. So you could say in a way, well, if we never saw round objects, we probably wouldn't dream of round objects. If you can imagine a world where everything is square, and how cars would run, but if you can imagine a world where everything is square, you would never have a dream of a circle. But when you do see a circle, then what gives it its power is you got an inner circle. So in a way, there is this dialectic between the outer and the inner, but the inner is always triggered by the outer, not caused by the outer. It's a big distinction. And it's easy to get messed up there.
Okay, what
Mary Kay
was saying, if it resonates.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Resonate is a good word here.
And I think there's also a resonance in the fact that these things do exist, like that circles exist is because there's a resonance in, you know, whatever it is that makes the universe. So circles appear, you know, and then there's a resonance in us and then also in the physical world. So, mm-hmm. like, if there's an inner circle in us, we will live in a world where there are circles. Mm-hmm. It can't not happen.
Right.
You know, like, we can't develop in a square universe because we're full of inner circles, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, at some depth. I think they both happen the same way.
Yep. But you're saying the distinction that's real important is the inner is triggered.
Triggered, not caused by.
Triggered, not caused by the outer.
Mm-hmm. More that the inner causes the outer, if you want to stick to the word cause. Even that's not quite right. Yeah. Makes possible, you might say. Mm-hmm. Makes possible the outer. This is all reworked Immanuel Kant. If you're curious. Then on AD and 81, she gets into different layers of the unconscious. Do we need to go through that, or is that clear? Is that okay? You go from ego to personal unconscious, to group unconscious, to national unconscious, to universal unconscious, to unus mundus.
When I first looked at that image on page 80, I thought about the Mandelbrot set, but yet there's really no parallel.
You thought about what, I'm sorry?
The Mandelbrot set, you know, fractals.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
How has that look? But there's really no parallel because in the Mandelbrot set, each little unit has self-similarity to the whole, and here it does not.
No, so right.
It doesn't, like, I mean, do you think, is it like a holographic kind of thing, that each thing is similar?
Well, you know how if you plug in equations to the Mandelbrot set and then you work them out, it gives you a visual image.
Yes.
The fractal. Mm-hmm. And each piece of the fractal reflects the whole, mm-hmm. reflects that same shape. It's repeated to infinity.
Yes.
And
it's the same as a holograph.
Each.
Also. Mm-hmm. Each one is
each, mm-hmm. Each piece is self-similar, but in her, which, you know, I looked at this and I thought, immediately thought of that, but then I'm not self-similar because her pieces, for one piece is consciousness and the other piece is, a different level of the unconscious and then the collective unconscious. So
but isn't there an underlying, similarity though? Like that one sort of evolves out of the other?
Well, they're not like repeating.
That's
not,
true.
Like,
that's
a
not
a repetition.
Correct. That's true. It's not an exact reproduction.
Yeah.
But
that's why. Mm-hmm. What is a fractal? I'm sorry. I don't even know what that is. That's an image that you can create using this algorithm called the Mandelbrot set. And if you plug values in, and then you you know, I guess they really, they run them on a computer. And then that those values create a certain image. And this image is actually related to complexity because it shows how things happen in nature that seem random, but actually aren't, because you can use this to... This is what allowed CGI effects, you know, to make mountains and water look so realistically, because they use that algorithm to recreate nature, which before, if you wanted to take, say, water, for example, and, you know, create that with computer graphics in a movie, you know, it didn't really look like water, but now they can do that using this algorithm, because it allows them to reproduce the... There is a formula underneath the chaos of nature.
Like, if you look at the way a tree branches, if you just draw some random tree, somebody can look at it and tell you, like, oh, that doesn't look quite natural. But if you use the Mandelbrot set and make the branches go according to that theory, it will branch in a way that looks like a real tree. You know, so that the way a tree branches, if you can actually use a mathematical equation to make a tree branch in the way that is in accordance to nature. You know, and if you do it against that, anybody can look at it and go, that just doesn't look quite right. You know, so that, like, the way leaves branch and all of that. So it's a mathematical explanation of what looks like total randomness in nature, like the way a tree develops is a good example. But if you go according to the mathematical equation, you'll get something that looks natural. If you go against it, it will not look natural, and you can look at it instantly, and someone will go, that looks like it's supposed to look, or that doesn't look like it's supposed to look, and it's a mathematical way of, like, the angles at which the branches come off and all of that. You know, but so it's a way of explaining how seemingly random chaotic events develop according to an underlying mathematical theory.
Right? Yeah, some examples. If you take the veins in a leaf,
yes,
and compare them to the structure of the branches, they're the same.
Yeah.
Which is the same as the way water flows at a delta,
mm-hmm.
which is the same as aspects of the circulatory system.
Yeah, the arterial and venous branches.
So they're said, they're randomly created, but mm-hmm. interesting how they're randomly created and they all look the same. And I think if you take the pattern of the coastline of a country, say, and then you zoom in to the pattern, say, of a state, you'll see the same shapes. What is thought to be random repeats itself on a small scale and then on a large scale. That's a fractal. So the idea is that that randomness is somehow patterned because it's always similar.
And is it true that the way that this, I've been trying to look at this and it's just confusing me, but is it true that, like, in the multi-universe theory, they've got the pattern down that would explain how that might possibly be true, they just can't find the evidence?
Correct, exactly. Right. No one has yet found.
But it does fit the model.
Because the model's there, that's why they're theorizing. Right. But we have a model that explains how it could be possible. We've never experienced it, you know, and we don't know how we could.
I think if they find the Higgs boson,
mm-hmm.
then they might have a way.
Because that may exist, right, in
another dimension.
Yeah. So that's true. Like, once we can open that doorway into that dimension, if we could see this thing that we fits the mathematical model, and yet we have no physical evidence of, other than gravity works, you know, as an example. Yeah.
And that's what CERN is all about, the Large Hadron mm-hmm. Collider mm-hmm. over there. That's the big excitement about that. In fact, they do call that boson, I think I mentioned before, they call it the God particle.
Oh, that's the God particle.
Yeah.
Just an interesting aside, I have a second cousin that worked at CERN, and he died of alcoholism at age 50.
I knew some physicists who did work at CERN. They lived in Zurich and they'd commute. They were a strange bunch of people.
Did he die before the LHC came online?
I don't. He just died a few years ago.
Because that killed there. A lot of people when that thing exploded when they turned
no,
off.
No, he died.
Emotionally.
Yeah, he died of cirrhosis, and he was having trouble before he ever got over there. But
funny, he's having trouble with spirits and he's looking for the God particles.
Right. I see connections there.
Well, it's actually a miserable life working at CERN because you're an expat. You don't have any friends. You may have, you know, a Bulgarian and a whatever, and you're an American, you have maybe three Americans working there, and it's lonely. And, you know, Switzerland's not a particularly hospitable place if you don't have an inn. And plus, they're all geniuses. So
yeah.
It's a mess.
That impairs your social skills right
Yeah. Anyway, what's all this have to do with psychology, you might be asking. Never fear, we will make a link. Let's go to the Unus Mundus. I think you're okay with complexes.
And
we're on page 80. So I'm now going to focus on circle A, on page 80. And circle, well, there's no circle that corresponds to it on page 81. But most of you have done inner work. You know what a complex is. You know what it's like to be bashed around by one. Let's go back to the shadow. You have a intense negative feeling about somebody or about some situation. Or take the anima or animus. You know, you're obsessed with eros about something. It feels like you're just sitting in a soup that never ends. If you can stay true to that process, you will learn a lesson. I'm making it a little simple now, but you will learn a lesson out of that shadow experience. Or you will learn a lesson out of the anima experience. And you will realize that lesson has gotten me somewhere. It moves me forward in my life direction. And if you stick with the process and face several of these shadow battles, several of these anima battles, each one you will realize has given you a new insight to live life more fully, more enjoyably, more creatively. And again, if you've gone through several, you realize, damn, these insights are related. All this misery is leading me somewhere. That is to say, as you hear the lesson in the particular difficulty that you're living through. Which means there is a secret ordering in the chaos of complexes. That's the self. So all our talk about, you know, orders and repetitive forms and secret dimensions isn't too far off psychology, because we do notice that the misery of life, if dealt with consciously, begins to guide us. The Unus Mundus is simply a word for that. Unus means Unus Mundus, one world, which Jung coined to try to give a word to the fact that not only do these experiences begin to lead us somewhere, but the outer world often cooperates. So that symbolic process is not only that symbolic, the guidance behind the particular stages of misery, not only guides us inwardly, but when we're ready for the right outer possibility to receive our inner readiness, it will appear. So the Unus Mundus is an attempt to extend this concept of archetype beyond the individual. We don't know what it is. That's why I find these discussions, though frustrating, very relevant. Scientists are, interestingly, pursuing the same question. Is there an order to nature? Each one's got their own little way of going about it, whether it's string theory or chaos theory or complexity theory or fractals, but they're all saying, there is some order to nature which we haven't quite recognized, which of course goes against the fundamental idea of science, that there is no teleology. There is no purpose to nature. There clearly must be a purpose to nature. We just can't figure out how to conceptualize it. And Jung then gave the word Unus Mundus to this bit, that images seem to evolve over time when the emotional storms that they are hiding in are dealt with. And that is not culturally, where all these others are, certainly the earlier complexes are either related to your family, related to your culture, related to your country. This unus mundus seems to operate in everybody the same way everywhere, as far as Jung can see.
But it's our own unus mundus.
Well, it couldn't be our own if it responds from the world. We are certainly in it, but I don't think Jung would say it's in us. It's, here language fails us. Understanding fails us. It couldn't be individual only, or everyone, or only one person could have a synchronicity. But we all have synchronicity. So it's bigger than me, yet my synchronicity is specific to what I need, so yes, there is a personal aspect to it. So let's hear the border between individual and outer world breaks down.
Can a collective group have a synchronicity?
Sure, yeah. I remember Von Franz telling a dream she had World War II. Zurich to Germany is about a 45-minute drive, not even that, probably half an hour drive. So it'd be like here at Kokomo. And, you know, there were thousands of tanks amassed, ready to charge in. She had a dream, Brüder Klaus, remember Brüder Klaus, the patron saint of Switzerland? She had a dream that Brüder Klaus came to the Germans and put a hand up, and she knew that they wouldn't attack. So that's a collective experience, I think. Now, was that, who knows what that was, but when they could have decimated Switzerland, the whole country with, they would have had to pay a high price, but still they could have taken the country. Trying to think other synchronicities of a group. Anyone else think of any? It's harder to tell because with a group, you're more likely to think, well, it's a historical event and not a synchronicity. I'll have to think about that, but I think we'd have to say the groups can have them too. You may or may not agree, but I remember Von Franz saying in a conference that she felt Chernobyl was a response to our disregard of nature. Mm-hmm. A kind of a world synchronicity.
You know, they just showed something, a special on Chernobyl, and wildlife is thriving there. Hmm. Not affected by the radiation at all, and they can't figure out why.
But people have been seriously affected, I think.
Well, they don't allow people to stay in that.
Oh. But I mean, the people who were around,
Who worked there. But yeah. The wildlife has moved back in.
So harmful to humans, but not to other species, apparently.
Well,
or they're not taking chances to see if it's harmful to humans.
You know, perhaps, no, they're not seeing if the human population could do that because they don't want to take that chance. Mm-hmm. But perhaps even the human population could go in there and quickly rise, although we wouldn't accept the initial problems that come with it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, on the other hand, as far as I know, you know, I was raised not too far from Three Mile Island, and as far as I know, they have a high incidence of, I don't know if you know that.
Correct.
High incidence around Three Mile Island.
Cancer, lymphoma, leukemia, yeah. I mean, all the kind of things we see with radiation exposure. Although there is a group of elderly people living in a small town near Chernobyl that they are absolutely not allowed to live there, but they would not move, like they moved back. And they're like in their 70s and 80s and seem healthy. And they had a reporter go in, and of course they're offered them like cookies. Like, I'm not going to eat that stuff because it's all bloody radioactive. Mm-hmm. But there are some people that are living there, and some of the people that moved away died because they were so attached to their home. You know, and so some people that are living there, like, I'm not moving out of my home. You know, my family's lived here for generations. And there are people that are living there without obvious evidence of diseases. You know, so it's like there may be a population which can adapt to the radiation. You know, the majority, you know, people get sick and just what happens, happens. But the funny thing is it doesn't happen to everybody. You know, that in Three Mile Island, it could be everybody's exposed to the same dose of radiation. And yes, there is a much higher incidence of both solid organ cancers and leukemia and all that kind of stuff. But not everybody gets it. So the question is, you know, like these wildlife that's living there and these elderly people that are living there, there may be ways the body can adapt at a great price. You know, people are sacrificed, people die, those who can't adapt, people are gone, but, you know, it may be possible to live with radiation and you know, our bodies can maybe adapt to that in some people. And
just like evolution, it's...
Right.
Let's take a break.